In this lecture, we're going to learn about excise warehouses. Before we get into the ins and outs about what an excise warehouse is, there is quite a lot of legislation that we need to get through first. Firstly, we'll start with European legislation. Council Directive 9212 EEC authorises member states to lay down conditions for the granting of approvals and controlling excise warehouses. This directive has been rewritten to improve clarity, and Council Directive 2008/118/EC has replaced it. It entered into force on January the 15th, 2009, and member states had until January the 1st, 2010 to adopt national laws to ensure compliance with it from the 1st of April 2010. Some of the national legislation has already been put into legal effect because a lot of the provisions of the new directive exactly replicate the law as it stood in the old 1992 directive. We'll cover these existing pieces of UK legislation in a second. However, as some of the provisions in the new 2008 directive are totally new, a statutory instrument has been enacted. It is number 593 of 2010 and is called the Excise Goods Holding, Movement and Duty Point Regulations. This regulation revokes some of the existing UK statutory instruments, either totally or in part. Most of the provisions in the new SI take effect from the 1st of April 2010. Others come into effect on the 1st of January 2011. One of the key pieces of legislation contained in the new statutory instrument is the Excise Movement and Control System, or EMCS for short, which took effect from the 1st of April 2010. This is a computerised monitoring system of the movements of excise goods in duty suspension within the EU and replaces the paper-based system that was contained in the old 1992 directive. The new electronic system should help to improve efficiency and reduce fraud. Before we get into this new system and the rest of excise warehousing, we'll introduce other pieces of UK legislation that you might need to become familiar with. Regulation 2719 of 92 covers the documentation required to accompany excisable goods when held under excise duty suspension. In the UK, the relevant legislation is contained in a variety of statutory instruments. For example, SI 809 of 1988, the Excise Warehousing Regulations, contain many of the details about how goods must be received into a warehouse, operations that may be carried out on them, conditions that must be satisfied when goods are removed from the warehouse, and the types of returns and records that a warehouse keeper must have. The Excise Goods Holding, Movement, Warehousing and REDS regulations used to contain rules about when excise duty was due and the documentation that was needed to accompany excise goods as they moved from a warehouse. These regulations have been revoked by our new 2010 statutory instrument. The warehouse keepers and owners of warehouse goods regulations contained in statutory instrument 1278 of 1999 contain the rules about approvals and registration of warehouse keepers and conditions and restrictions that apply to them. And finally, the excise goods accompanying documents regulations used to contain details about the documentation that must accompany excise goods when they left a warehouse. Again, the majority of this statutory instrument has been revoked by our 2010 regulations. So far, you can see there is quite a lot of legislation on excise warehouses. We'll cover the relevant statutory references as we go along, so you can look them up as we cover them. First, an introduction as to what an excise warehouse is. Essentially, an excise warehouse is a place that is authorised by customs where excisable goods may be stored without being subject to excise duty. In this regard, they are often referred to as excise duty suspended goods. The types of goods that can be held within an excise warehouse are products that contain alcohol, hydrocarbon oils, and tobacco products. Although in the latter case, they must not be manufactured in the UK for home use. We have already mentioned that the main point of an excise warehouse is that goods stored within it are covered by duty suspension. An excise warehouse can, therefore, be useful in the following scenario. Imagine that you acquire excisable goods from another member state. Now, some people might think, why would we need an excise warehouse in this situation? Hasn't excise duty been paid in the other member state? Well, remember in one of our very first lectures, We said that excise duties are member state specific. So even if excise duties have been paid in another member state, they are still due in the UK at the UK rates. Excise duties are due in the country of consumption. Also, if the goods are coming from an excise warehouse based in the other member state, then they would not have had any excise duties paid on them at all yet. Becoming approved as an excise warehouse allows you to receive the goods without having to pay the excise duty straight away. In addition to storing imported goods without payment of excise duty, certain home-produced goods can also be stored there without excise duty being incurred. For example, imagine that you are a distiller of spirits in the UK. Provided those goods are consigned upon production to an excise warehouse, then excise duty does not need to be paid at that point in time. The authority for this is contained in Section 92 of the Customs and Excise Management Act. So, if all of these goods can be entered into an excise warehouse without excise duty becoming due, when does it have to be paid? Well, the duty point is when the goods are removed from the warehouse. You can see this in Regulation 6 of Statutory Instrument 593 of 2010. There are some exceptions to this rule, which we will come on to later. Now we know the legislation relating to excise warehousing and what goods can be stored in an excise warehouse, we need to look at how approval is obtained. If a person wishes to operate an excise warehouse, they must be approved by customs. Approval is granted under Section 92 of CEMA 1979. An application for authorization of an excise warehouse is made on Form EX68 if you apply for a general storage and distribution warehouse, or Form EX69 if you apply for a trade facility warehouse. You will learn more about these types of warehouse in a minute. Application for warehouse premises approval must be made as well. In order to have your premises approved, customs will require a plan showing the area and also a copy of a health and safety risk assessment. Generally, a person should apply at least 30 days in advance of wishing to become authorised. Authorisation may require the warehouse keeper to provide customs with a premises guarantee. This guarantee is usually provided by a bank or insurance company. The guarantee will be called upon in the event of an irregularity occurring, for example, a loss of excise duty arises. The level of security required is usually based on the excise duty due on the average end-of-month stock contained within the premises. A trader can check Public Notice 196 for the amounts of security required. For example, where the potential duty due on an average month-end stock holding is less than £100,000, no security is required. Where the potential duty is more than £100 million, the security required is £1 million. The minimum level of security for a new general storage and distribution warehouse is £250,000. Customs may offer a reduction of guarantee levels for established traders in certain circumstances. A movement security is also required to cover any loss of excise duty for goods whilst in transit, after leaving an excise warehouse and before arriving at their destination. Once approved, a certificate of registration will be issued to the warehouse keeper. As part of the approval, a warning poster, which is contained in Public Notice 50, must be displayed at each entrance and exit to the warehouse site. The poster states that goods in the warehouse may not have had excise duty paid on them, and that anybody who improperly moves the goods could be liable to criminal sanctions. Where an excise warehouse keeper trades with excisable goods from other member states, his excise warehouse will also be called a tax warehouse. Generally, approval will be granted for a 12-month initial period. Once customs are happy that operations are running as they should be, then they will renew for a further period. Renewal should generally be made at least 2 months before the expiry date. For applications from the 1st of April 2010, a trader wishing to become authorised as a warehouse keeper must also have registered for access to the Excise Movement and Control System, or EMCS for short, within the online services offered by HMRC. Access to EMCS will be required for receiving goods that are dispatched to a warehouse keeper on this system. The EMCS is an electronic system for recording and validating all movements of duty suspended excise goods within the EU. From the 1st of April 2010, The system will progressively replace the current paper-based system, which requires an AAD to accompany all movements. Instead of a paper AAD, under the EMCS, an electronic record known as an EAD must be raised on the EMCS before the movement can commence. Some member states will be able to electronically raise both dispatch and receipt documents. Other member states, which include the UK, are able to currently raise receipt documents through the electronic system, but not dispatches. These dispatches will still be accompanied by a paper AAD, which you'll learn about more in a bit. All member states are required from the 1st of January 2011 to be able to record both dispatches and receipts through the EMCS. Carrying on with approvals of warehouses, excise warehouses can take one of three forms. The first two are the main types. These are a general storage and distribution warehouse and a trade facility warehouse. Final one is a motor and heating warehouse. We will concentrate on the first two. In order to be authorised for a general storage and distribution warehouse, a person must have a minimum potential duty of £500,000 on their average monthly stock holding, or a minimum duty liability of £2 million annually. If either of these is not satisfied, the person will not be authorised for this particular type of excise warehouse. A trade facility warehouse will be authorised where goods are stored for certain purposes. Firstly, the maturation of spirits produced at an associated distillery. Secondly, goods that will not suffer excise duty. For example, goods that are destined for export or use in pharmaceuticals or use in foodstuffs. Or, for performing an allowable operation on the goods, or for any other purposes allowed by customs. To be authorised as a trade facility warehouse, you do not need those minimum throughput levels as we saw for a general storage and distribution warehouse. These levels are not listed anywhere in the legislation, but can be found in Public Notice 196. Once the goods have arrived in the excise warehouse, can any operations be carried out on them? Regulation 14 of Statutory Instrument 809 of 1988 provides that customs may allow the operations described in Schedule 1 and other operations where they feel that the collection of excise duty will not be prejudiced in any way. Schedule 1 contains the following operations: sorting, separating, packing or repacking, and such other operations as are necessary for preservation, sale, shipment or disposal of the goods, rectifying and compounding of spirits, rendering sparkling of wine and made wine, the mixing of a fermented liquor or a liquor derived from a fermented liquor with any other liquor or substance so as to produce made wine, the mixing of lime or lemon juice with spirits for shipment as stores or for exportation, and denaturing, reducing, marrying and blending. Under Regulation 14.2, Public Notice 196 also gives a list of other types of operations that customs may allow. These include cask rinsing, colouring, filtering, sweetening and priming of beer. Now we are going to look at the warehouse keeper's responsibilities when goods are received into an excise warehouse. It is important to note that not just anybody can deposit goods into an excise warehouse. Subject to a few exceptions, goods can only be received from registered owners. This is provided for in Regulation 9.1 and 2 of Statutory Instrument 1278 of 1999. Take the following illustration. The goods arrive by lorry to the excise warehouse. The warehouse keeper must ensure that he can comply with Regulation 11 onwards of Statutory Instrument 809 of 1988. These require the warehouse keeper to physically check the goods on arrival, enter the goods into his stock records, and the goods must then be put into the warehouse. A certificate of safe receipt should be sent back to the consignor within 5 days of the goods being warehoused. Note that customs can allow derogations from these requirements. Where the warehouse keeper fails to comply with his conditions, the goods can be liable to forfeiture. Warehouse goods should be kept secure and marked so that they can be identified in the stock records. Typically, the stock records should contain the following information: a full description of the goods, including alcoholic strength and quantity, where alcohol is stored, the location of the goods so that they can be identified in the warehouse, a stock number that has been allocated to the goods so that they can be identified, details about the owner of the goods, and details of any sales, transfers, or operations that have taken place whilst the goods were in the warehouse. Once the goods have been received into the warehouse, the warehouse keeper needs to keep a close eye on the goods to ensure that losses and tampering do not occur, except those that are due to accidental or natural causes. This requires them to ensure a good system of stock control. The stock control legislation is contained in Regulation 12 of SI 809 of 1988. We'll imagine that our warehouse keeper is warehousing alcoholic goods for the following illustration. Every month, the warehouse keeper must submit a stock return to customs for the type of alcoholic goods being warehoused. In addition, an annual stock take is usually required to reconcile the number of goods in the warehouse to the trader's account. Any errors between the annual stock take and the trader's records need to be reported to customs. If the warehouse keeper fails to carry out these duties, then the goods are once again liable to forfeiture. What happens when excise goods are removed from the warehouse? The procedure to follow is covered by Regulations 16 and 17 of SI 809 of 1988. The procedure for removals depends on where the goods are destined for. Here we have a map of the British Isles and our authorised excise warehouse. Some of these goods may be destined for export to a non-EU member state. Where this happens, normal export procedures must be followed. For instance, the appropriate export declaration, or C88, would need to be completed. No excise duty is due where goods are exported directly from the excise warehouse. Before the export occurs, the warehouse keeper must take account of the goods and check that the goods leaving correspond to the export declaration, and he must write the goods out of the stock account and keep details of the goods that have been removed. He must also supervise the removal to ensure that there is no tampering before the goods are exported. Commercial evidence of export must be kept by the warehouse keeper, and customs may want to inspect this to prove that no excise duty was due on the goods. Where goods are removed to home use, i.e. they are going to be consumed in the UK, then excise duty will be paid, and the rate applicable is that at the time the goods are removed from the warehouse. The legal basis for this is Regulation 26 of the same statutory instrument. A daily list of removals needs to be provided to customs and the duty paid on them. However, paying daily can be an administrative burden. Therefore, a duty deferment account can be used to ensure that payment of excise duty happens once every month. By virtue of the Excise Duties Deferred Payment Regulations of 1992, payment is made by the 29th day of the second month for charges deferred between the 15th month of the first month to the 14th of the second month. Usually, a guarantee is required. However, under the Excise Payment Security System, EPPS, deferred payment can be made without the need for a guarantee. For example, excise duty deferred between the 15th of March to the 14th of April is due by the 29th of April. Alternatively, a trader may be authorised for scheduling, which negates the need for daily removals as well as allowing deferment of payment. We will look at this in a little while. Continuing with the types of removal, goods may be transferred between excise warehouses without duty becoming due. As goods travelling between excise warehouses have not yet had excise duty paid on them, various procedures must be carried out. We'll look at the current paper-based system. This must be used unless the movement takes place under EMCS. Firstly, the goods must be accompanied by a Form W8 or a commercial equivalent. This document must give information about the goods, such as the date the goods were removed from the warehouse, details of the dispatching and receiving excise warehouse, a description of the goods, including their commodity code, the value of the goods, the quantity and strength of the goods, and the stock number. If the goods should go missing on the journey, then excise duty will be payable, and it is payable by whoever has guaranteed the movement. This certificate must be kept, as it confirms that the excise movement was carried out correctly and excise duty is not due on it. As well as goods being sent between excise warehouses, goods can be sent to another EU member state, for instance France, under the duty suspension regime. This can only be done if the person who is receiving the goods is an authorised person. If the person in the other member state is not authorised, then the goods cannot be dispatched until the UK warehouse keeper receives evidence from the consignee that they have paid the excise duty in the other member state. This evidence must be received by the dispatching warehouse and then travel with the goods. For goods being consigned to an authorized person, the goods must travel with an accompanying administrative document, or AAD for short. Four copies are usually required. Copies 2 to 4 will travel with the goods, and copy 1 is kept by the consignor. When the goods arrive, the consignee endorses copy 3 and returns it to the consignor by the 15th of the month following which the goods were received. Upon receipt of the endorsed copy 3, the consignor's liability is discharged. We can also receive goods from an excise warehouse in another member state. The documentation described in the above paragraph then works in reverse. That is, we endorse copy 3 of the AAD and send it back to the consignor in the other member state. So we have described what currently happens using the paper-based system. Under the EMCS, the paper-based copies referred to above will be replaced with an electronic administrative document known as an EAD. This EAD must be raised on EMCS before the movement can commence. EMCS will provide an administrative reference code, ARC, that uniquely identifies the movement. The ARC must be noted on either a printed copy of the EAD or a commercial document which must accompany the goods.